What are the chances of evolution happening? What are the chances of life just emerging from random forces? Well, we're going to talk about that right now with Dr. Stephen Meyer, who is the author of the best-selling book, Darwin's Doubt. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. And Dr. Meyer, so great to have you back on the program.
It's great to be with you.
And I should point out that your book is a New York Times best-selling book. And before I forget, give us your website where people can get more information on the book and all your articles and so forth.
Sure. It's called darwinsdoubt.com.
Oh, that's easy. Okay.
www.darwinsdoubt. Yep.
And there's no apostrophe there. Okay.
No apostrophe in Darwin's.
Okay. So what are the chances of evolution having created life? What are the chances of life just having arisen on its own? And we always have to remember when it comes to probability science that zero times any number is still zero.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a broader context for considering this question that actually started about 50 years ago. There was a conference held at a place called the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, and it was convened by a bunch of MIT scientists who were asking essentially the question you're asking me. What are the mathematical probabilities associated with the origin of even a single new gene, or which is a section of DNA, or protein? Because all living cells require the information in DNA and the functions that proteins perform. And the reason this question came up in the mid-60s among all these mathematically inclined scientists at MIT was that at that time, scientists were for the first time realizing that DNA was really a coding system. It was a long molecule with chemical subunits that were functioning like alphabetic characters in a written language, or, say, digital characters in the section of computer code. And what we know from all systems of communication, in particular, communication systems that use an alphabetic, typographic, or digital system of conveying information, is that there's a lot more ways to arrange the characters that convey information that will be non-functional or non-meaningful than there are to arrange the characters in a way that will be functional or meaningful. And as the biologists were conveying to their colleagues in physics and computer science and math that, hey, inside the cell we have a communication system. We've got an information storage molecule called DNA that's directing the construction of all these proteins and protein machines. The physics and math people started saying, well, wait a minute, if that's true, what are the odds that a purely random mechanism of mutation and selection could generate anything fundamentally new? Because there's so many more ways to go wrong than right. We know that when we play Scrabble. If you reach into the bag and put the letters on the board at random, you're not likely to spell a word. And that's because there's so many more ways to arrange those English characters that will give you gibberish than will give you words or sentences. Same thing turns out to be true in computer science. And a lot of the computer scientists who were thinking about the biology were saying, I bet the same thing is true in the code of life. So that's where the question started, and at this famous conference in 66, proceedings published 50 years ago in 1967, there were some unanswered questions, one of which was, well, just how rare are the functional sequences in comparison to all the gibberish ones? If they're not that rare, then maybe evolution could skip from one functional arrangement to another fairly readily with just a few mutational changes and get lucky here and there. But if the functional sequences are super, super rare, exponentially rare, then the mechanism looks to be incredibly improbable or implausible, and not something that we can really place any weight on as far as a genuine scientific theory of life's origins.
Okay, and what was their conclusions?
Well, that was the big question that was left unanswered in the late 60s. In the 90s, scientist, and I write about this in my book, Darwin's Doubt, a scientist named Douglas Axe, who had done a PhD at Caltech, went off to Cambridge University to do a long-term postdoc, basically addressing that problem. How rare are the functional sequences in comparison to all the other ones? For every arrangement of letters in the Scrabble bag that won't give you a word, how many words are there? And he was essentially asking that question for biology, and he ended up answering the question with a very careful method of research, a kind of systematic, what's called mutagenesis, where he actually altered the DNA sequences in a very systematic way to see what the ratio was of functional to non-functional sequences. And it turned out to be a really scary number from the standpoint of neo-Darwinism. For every for a protein of about 150 amino acids in length, for every arrangement that gives you a functional protein, there are 10 to the 77th power arrangements that won't. And that's like a needle in a gigantic haystack with lots and lots of places to look and the needle being very obscured. So it's this turned out to be a pretty challenging number, scary number from the standpoint of the neo-Darwinian theory, because it suggested that the evolutionary process would even on the scale of billions of years would not have enough time to search a space that large and have a reasonable chance of finding those functional sequences. So the bottom line is the mutation selection mechanism does not look to be a plausible way of generating the genetic information necessary to build new proteins.
Well, but we're still talking about, you know, evolution supposedly being true. How do they deal with this? Do they just kind of ignore it for the general public, essentially?
I think there is a lot of ignoring for the general public, although there have been a number of conferences recently where the problems with neo-Darwinism are being increasingly acknowledged by people in the mainstream field of evolutionary biology. Last year at the Royal Society in
London,
the oldest and most august scientific body
in the
world.
Yeah, I've been
there. In London. Mm-hmm. A number of us attended the meeting, and it was a meeting about the current status of neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory and essentially the need for a new theory of evolution. And this was not the judgment of a bunch of star-crazed creationists or intelligent design proponents. This was the judgment of the mainstream evolutionary biologists, one of whom, Gerd Müller, started the conference with an extraordinary talk on the explanatory deficits of neo-Darwinism, among which he listed the origin of new biological form, the origin of biological complexity, and the abrupt appearance of the major groups of animals and plants in the fossil record. So things that a number of us have been talking about for years, problems with evolutionary theory, are now being acknowledged by people who are right in the center of the field of evolutionary biology, and they're saying, look, the mechanism of neo-Darwinism lacks the creative power to generate the new form and the new information that arises in the history of life, so we need a new mechanism.
Okay, now you quote in your book, Darwin's Doubt, you quote two evolutionary biologists who said, and this is as far back as 1969, quote, natural selection is the editor rather than the composer of the genetic message. I think this is really important, but I don't think this message that you're saying here, you know, that basically evolution is impossible and that evolutionists are admitting it, I don't think that's getting out there. And of course, on the other hand, I could hear somebody say, well, but the fact of the matter is we're here and we could only have gotten here through evolution. So evolution is still true, even though we can't explain what the mechanism is.
Well, and part of this is there's a lot of equivocation around the term evolution. Evolution can mean change over time. It can mean universal common ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
It can mean an unguided, undirected process such as mutation and natural selection that produced all the wonders of life that we see. Increasingly, I would say the evolutionary biologists are questioning that third meaning of evolution. They're very skeptical that the mutation natural selection mechanism has the creative power necessary to do the job. So in addition to the quote you just shared, there's another thing that we're hearing commonly is people saying that mutation and selection explain the survival but not the arrival of the fittest. They explain the small-scale adaptation to changes in environment that we see with things like Galapagos finches and peppered moths, but they don't explain where insects and birds and human beings and certainly the origin of the first life came from in the first place. So the major changes in the history of life are not well explained by the Darwinian mechanism, which really puts us back to 1859. Well, then what did cause those major changes? And that's where there's a lot of ferment and I would say even scrambling in the field where people are desperately looking for new mechanisms that might explain what the mutation selection mechanism allegedly explained, but now increasingly scientists recognize does not.
Okay, so going back to even just the simplest cell in the human body or whatever, what are the chances that could have just evolved?
Well, the the odds I calculated for the origin of a single gene or protein
which is one part of a cell, right?
Yeah. This is just a cell is made of lipids and carbohydrates and DNA and proteins and RNA, all these big what are called macromolecules. Probably the workhorses of the cell are the proteins, and the information for building them is encoded in DNA. So just at a minimum, to explain the origin of the first life, the first living cell, you would have to explain the origin of the first protein. But we don't just need one protein to service a cell. We need probably a minimally complex cell would need on the order of 400 proteins. So the odds against producing a single protein of a modest length would be on the order of what Doug Axe's work showed, one chance in 10 to the 77. But in a prebiotic environment, it's worse because there's some other factors that have to be considered. I calculated an odds for that one single protein at one chance in 10 to the 164th when you took all the factors into account. And then when you realize you've got about 400 different proteins that have their own independent probabilities, the numbers just blow up exponentially beyond any kind of reasonable level. And really, essentially, this is why people who are what are called origin of life researchers, the branch of evolutionary biology that's charged with explaining the origin of the first living cell coming from simpler non-living chemicals, have pretty much entirely rejected the chance hypothesis. They may still be looking for other naturalistic models, but nobody thinks it happened by chance. They think, well, maybe there was something biasing the search, maybe there were some undiscovered laws of nature, maybe there's some other scheme like what they call the RNA world, but nobody thinks it happened by chance.
Well, you have a quote here. This is from your book. You talk about many different combinations of amino acids will produce roughly the same protein structure and function. The sequences capable of producing these functional outcomes are still extremely rare. The probability of attaining a correct sequence by random search would roughly equal the probability of a blind spaceman finding a single marked atom by chance among all the atoms in the Milky Way galaxy. On its face, clearly not a likely outcome.
That's right, except I kind of understate it there, because the number of atoms in the galaxy is about 10 to the 65th power. So if we're looking for 1 out of 10 to the 65th, that's roughly a trillion times more likely than the actual odds of finding a single protein among that space of alternative possibilities of 10 to the 77th. A trillion is 10 to the 12th. So it's the looking for one atom in the galaxy gets at it, but it's the problem of finding a functional protein in what's called combinatorial sequence space, that is just all the other possible arrangements that correspond to the functional one, is actually much, much worse. So it's a big problem.
Okay, but now go ahead.
Well, and this illustration that might get this across too is one I use when teaching is just if you've got a bike lock and you've got a thief out in front of your school maybe, and he's going to try to break into crack the code so he crack the combination so he can steal the lock. The reason the lock works is that there's 10,000 possibilities, only one of which opens the lock. So unless the thief has got lots and lots of time and is especially diligent, he's not going to be able to break that lock with one over 10,000 possibilities. But you can change the thought experiment a little bit. Imagine the thief encounters a lock with 10 dials. Now if he spends his entire life twiddling the dials, he's only going to be able to sample a tiny fraction of that total 10 to the 10th number of possible ways of arranging the 10 digits on the 10 dials. So it's not plausible, even taking into account all the time available in his entire life, to search a space that large. But when we're talking about the protein, even a modest protein is going to be something like the odds are going to be like finding one combination on a bike lock with 77 dials. That's 10 to the 77th possibilities. And there it turns out that even 4 billion years, or 3.85 billion years, the accepted date for the origin of life, is not enough time to search a space that large with a reasonable probability of finding something. So when you're assessing the plausibility of a random search, you need to know how many combinations have to be searched, and also how much time is available. But the space of possibilities is so great in the case of the DNA protein system that even what they call evolutionary deep time, billions of years, is not enough to search but a tiny, tiny fraction of the total, thus making it much more likely that a random search would fail than succeed.
So at the end of the day, I mean, look, zero times anything.
It's not reasonable. It's not
reasonable.
Reasonable hypothesis.
It is not.
We conclude.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen Meyer, darwinsdoubt.com for more information. Thank you so much for being with us. God bless
and
all the best.
Thanks for having me on, Jerry. Yeah,
okay.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thank you now. Bye-bye.